Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition. Maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 9th of December. Our main stories. The FBI says it believes the Saudi officer who killed three people at a US Navy base acted alone. Police in India have arrested the owner of a factory where more than 40 people were killed in a fire. And restaurants in Saudi Arabia will no longer be required to provide separate entrances for men and women. Also in this podcast...
Huge slips, two I could see 200 metres long across the road. Massive amounts of debris, trees just spilled down onto the road.
Nearly 1,000 tourists are stuck in a remote part of New Zealand's South Island. The Saudi gunman who killed three sailors at the US Navy base where he was training is thought to have acted alone. That is the working assumption of the FBI. The agency is also treating the shooting as a terror attack, but hasn't made a final conclusion on either matter. No arrests have been made following the shooting in Pensacola, Florida. Special Agent Rachel Rojas told a news conference the authorities were questioning some other Saudi personnel.
There are a number of Saudi students who were close to the shooter and continue to cooperate in this investigation. Their Saudi commanding officer has restricted them to base, and the Saudi government has pledged to fully cooperate with our investigation.
However, some American politicians have called for an immediate halt to the Saudi military training program in the US, as I heard from our correspondent Chris Buckler in Washington.
It is interesting to listen to that news conference from the FBI and contrast it with some of the statements that are now being made by politicians in Florida. And a news conference is taking place at the moment involving, among others, the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, in which he has said very clearly, as far as he's concerned, people should not be coming to the United States if they hate our country, and that they need to be on the guard about foreign nationals coming across to train with foreign military, and pushing for this review, which the US Defense Secretary Mark Esper says has begun, into vetting procedures for all of those foreign personnel who are allowed to come and train on American military bases. And somebody else at that news conference from the authorities was saying there is a feeling that trust and hospitality has been betrayed in this case, and that there is real anger in the community, both among civilian people and among the military.
Yeah, is this quite a big thing, the US training foreign military, and what sort of training do they get?
Yeah, he was an aviation student, Mohammed Al-Shamrani. He was there as part of the Saudi Royal Air Force getting training. And this happens regularly. America obviously has Middle East allies. Most important Middle East allies is Saudi Arabia. And certainly this kind of program has been going on for some time. But if you listen to some Republican politicians in particular, there are real concerns about just how far this has gone and whether or not potentially they didn't really look at the vetting procedures hard enough, certainly in this case, because they are pointing out that there were warning signs, according to the US media, certainly in the 24 hours before he carried out this attack. There's a suggestion, for example, that Mohammed Al-Shamrani actually showed videos of mass shootings at a dinner party the night before the attack. And also they're pointing out that, according to US media reports, there were some warning signs from social media as well. So I think there is going to be real pressure on the authorities about this.
Chris Buckler. With the British general election just 3 days away, the party leaders have been making a final push to try to win over undecided voters. The early poll was called by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, saying he wanted to break the parliamentary deadlock over Brexit. His Conservative Party is leading in the opinion polls, but he says he doesn't want to be complacent.
We're now in the final furlong of this race, and that is when, of course, the horses can still change places. We are still not quite there yet, and do not forget what happened in 2017. We remember how this is a close-fought election, isn't it, everybody?
The main opposition Labour Party is focusing on its core message of protecting the National Health Service. Party leader Jeremy Corbyn said the NHS had been damaged by the policies of the previous Conservative government.
The price of austerity is not paid by the very rich. It's not paid by the billionaires, the 150 billionaires in Britain. It's paid for by those going through mental health stress. It's paid for by those that are homeless. It's paid for by our children going hungry. It's paid for by the underfunding of public services all over Britain.
I asked our political reporter, Jonathan Blake, given the Conservatives' lead, whether Boris Johnson had anything to worry about.
Oh, he does. It's by far from a sure thing that the Conservatives will win this election. You're right to point out that the polls do show a lead for Boris Johnson and his party, but they wouldn't have to be too far wrong for that to translate to another hung parliament where no one party has an overall majority and the Conservatives would be denied staying in power. You could then be looking at Labour, the opposition party, before this election, and perhaps the Scottish Nationalists and Liberal Democrats forming some sort of coalition. So while there is a lead in the polls, complacency is the enemy, certainly, for any party in a general election campaign. And over the next 2-3 days, you'll see the main party leaders going to all parts of the UK with their key messages. And that is, on the Conservative side, that a vote for them is to use their slogan, one to get Brexit done. And on the Labour Party side, it is to bring forward investment in public services in the UK to a level not seen for many decades.
And how important will tactical voting be, particularly perhaps from those who don't want to get Brexit done, for example?
Tactical voting is a key part of this election. What hasn't materialised is a sort of grand Remain alliance that many people were talking about before the vote was called. And that was an attempt by some of the opposition parties to use their firepower against the Conservatives to stop Boris Johnson getting a majority, with the aim of reversing the vote to leave the European Union and keeping the UK in somehow. Most people would want to do that by having another referendum to put the choice again to the British people. But there will be pockets of tactical voting in certain areas, certain marginal seats. That will be something that people are doing to perhaps lend their vote to another party to stop the Conservatives getting in. But we'll have to wait till the results are in to see how effective that's been on a national level.
Our political reporter, Jonathan Blake. The worst fire for 2 decades in the Indian capital, Delhi, has left at least 43 people dead. The huge blaze tore through a factory in the city's congested old quarter. It began at about 5 a.m. Many of those who died had been sleeping and were trapped inside.
My nephew called his father and said, "Please save me, there's a fire in the building and I'm unable to escape." The last call came at 5:30 in the morning. After that, the phone kept ringing and he couldn't get in touch. And only later we came here and found out he'd died.
My brother received a call that the building was on fire, to come and save them. He told them not to be scared and to be strong and to call 100 for help. This was the only conversation, and after that we couldn't reach them.
I went to the place where they keep the corpses and I showed a photograph of my relatives, and the doctor showed me their bodies. Today is a very dark day.
Kishmar Singh, who works at a local hospital, helped treat the injured. He said many people in the building had suffocated.
Most of them slept late in the night, 2:30 or 12:30 or so. Smoke has woke them up, and those who could wake up and cling to the window, they are the one who survived.
The factory owner has been arrested, with officials saying the building didn't have fire safety equipment. Our correspondent Pratiksha Girdiyal is in Delhi.
This part of Delhi where the fire broke out is a really congested and dense part of the city. It's lined with narrow alleyways, hanging wires from houses and electric poles, so that it's very difficult for a big vehicle like a fire engine to access any of these alleys. As a result, firefighters were having to fight the blaze from a distance of about 100 meters, and they were having to rescue people manually by going inside the alleys and carrying them out one by one. A pretty difficult rescue, but unfortunately very common sight across India.
And what does it look like? Is the building still standing?
The building is still standing. It's a 4- or 5-storey building, and reportedly the fire started on the ground floor at night and very quickly spread to the other levels of the building. And because these workers were sleeping inside, a lot of them died because of suffocation. Many of them probably didn't even know that there was a fire. But I have just been to a hospital where some of the injured have been admitted, and I've been speaking to families and relatives, and they all have some very heart-wrenching stories to tell. One of them said her 25-year-old brother died, and he didn't even know that he had been blessed with a baby son today, just this morning.
And police are now opening a criminal investigation into the owner of the building. And firefighters say there was no safety equipment there and it had no fire safety certificate.
Exactly. And again, unfortunately, a very common story again all across India. The fire safety standards are really dismal in big cities where buildings don't have proper fire exits. There's a lot of illegal construction. So people build stories after stories, which is also a hazard. So now an investigation has been launched into what caused this incident, whether this building was legally carrying out its business there, whether it had taken all the safety standards that are required of businesses. They have arrested one person in connection with this who's said to be the owner of the building. There will be an investigation, no doubt. And because it has happened in the national capital of Delhi, condolences are pouring in from the highest levels of leadership. Prime Minister Narendra Modi offered his condolences. But this is going to come as little consolation for the families of the victims who are still coming to terms with this tragedy.
Pratiksha Gildial in Delhi. Nearly 1,000 tourists are stuck in a remote part of New Zealand's South Island after torrential rains caused a massive landslide, blocking the main highway. It could take days to clear. Lewis is a British tourist currently stranded in the rainforest retreat in the small town of Franz Josef.
The day we got here, the rain had been bad for like 3-4 days already. And the night we were here, we found out the roads had collapsed in and out. Hence why we're stuck here 4 days later. It's easy to get frustrated and upset at this moment in time, but it's no one's fault. There will be a way out of here one way or another. The people here are nice, the locals are friendly. So like, it's a difficult situation, but it's not like a very like trying and testing one. Like it will be okay in the end. I'll admit I'm one of the lucky ones because I've not got to leave New Zealand until the 8th of January. But this has definitely affected quite a few people with like very strict itineraries.
Conan Young is a reporter with Radio New Zealand who flew into Franz Josef by helicopter.
You can't go north and you can't go south. It's because of huge slips and washouts where the road's just been completely washed away or subsided. So the latest is that the 1,000 tourists who I'm here with in Franz Josef, they will not be able to drive out of here until at least Friday. And that's heading south from here. And that's going to take quite an effort, even just that, for the road crews to get that bit of the road reopened. As far as the road north goes, that could be out for 4 weeks at least. I flew over that area, actually, which is sort of the main road out of here heading north, and it was just incredible. There's one spot, Mount Hercules, that the road comes over, and that really bore the brunt of the storm that this area has experienced in the last few days. Huge slips, I could see 200 metres long across the road, massive amounts of debris, trees just spilled down onto the road. The road disappeared in at least two places that I could see, and a bridge had completely washed away. I mean, we've still got electricity here in Franz Josef. The water's running fine. There's plenty of accommodation. Food is arriving. So things aren't too bad, but I'd imagine as, you know, the days drag on here, some people might start to get a bit impatient.
Conan Young of Radio New Zealand. It's arguably the most famous chess match in history, the 1972 clash between American Bobby Fischer and the Russian Boris Spassky. The battle for the World Chess Championship in Reykjavik was seen by many as a proxy for the Cold War. A new play that's just opened in London reconstructs the match and delves into the sometimes troubled personality of the winner, Bobby Fischer. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd reports.
You obviously consider yourself the best chess player in the world. Does it ever strike you that that's arrogant?
No. If it's true, it's not arrogant.
It was pre-internet, pre-mobile phone and pre-24-hour news. The proceedings would be slow. The location, Iceland, was generally ignored by the media. Yet, 47 years ago, a chess match between America and the USSR would be massive news for weeks.
The International Chess Federation wants word by tomorrow morning from Fischer on whether he's agreeable to 24 games in Iceland, and Fischer is taking his time answering.
So once again, the championships are on, and the Icelanders are obviously hoping that there will be no further demands from Robert James Fischer that would once again jeopardize the future of the championships.
Bobby Fischer was challenging the most recent of the Soviet masters who dominated chess since the 50s, Boris Spassky. It was Fischer's mercurial personality which dominated, as Tom Morton Smith's new play at the Hampstead Theatre shows.
The Chess Federation is a communist front.
We have commitments. We have contracts. I am not going to renege on...
If you move the game back into the arena, I will take a hammer and smash the board to pieces.
Gentlemen, please.
I'm Robert Ems, and I play Bobby Fischer. The interesting thing with him is the contradiction. He was Jewish, but he was anti-Semitic. He was American, but didn't feel any kind of patriotism to being American. Yeah, he was, you know, mentally unstable. And I think if looking back into his past life and his history and his growing up and his relationship with his mother and the absence of his father later on, finding out who his father was after he died, had an immense effect on him.
Ronan Raftery plays Boris Spassky.
He was a very even chess player, a very calm, focused performer, but we kind of know a lot more about the inner turmoil that he was dealing with at the time and how upset he was by Fischer's behavior and how this game that he loved more than anything became this proxy war for a global international fight between two superpowers, and he hated that.
Fischer was the eventual winner, but now world famous as no chess player had ever been, for 20 years he almost disappeared. In 1992, there was an unofficial rematch, which he also won. Then, after the 9/11 attacks, his anti-US comments on Philippines radio made most American fans give up on him.
Well, this is all wonderful news. It's time for the US to get their heads kicked in.
Bobby Fischer moved to Iceland and he died there in 2008. No one can question his genius at the chessboard, but actor Robert Ems doubts it brought Fischer any contentment ever.
He'd already defined himself. He wanted to claim what he felt was rightfully his, to overcome everybody and everything, and he wanted the perfect pure game. But did that complete him like he felt like it was going to complete him? Probably not.
That report by Vincent Dowd. And still to come on the podcast.
In the same way that as the artist put the banana on the wall, he say, I'm coming here to eat the banana. That's my performance. And he left and the police removed him from the fair.
The $120,000 artwork eaten by a rival artist. Rwanda has launched its first vaccination campaign against the Ebola virus. More than 2,200 people have died of the disease in neighbouring Congo since August last year. Our Africa editor Mary Harper reports.
Rwanda's health minister Diane Gashumba said 200,000 people would be vaccinated over the next year in areas bordering the Democratic Republic of Congo. Priority will be given to health workers, immigration officials, police and those engaged in cross-border trade. So far, there have been no confirmed Ebola cases in Rwanda. The authorities are hoping the experimental vaccine will keep things that way. It was used for the first time last month in the city of Goma in eastern Congo. A quarter of a million Congolese have already been vaccinated with another product. Both are made by US drug companies.
Mary Harper. Later today, the Executive Committee of the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, will make a decision that could have a huge impact on Russia and its international reputation. The Russians are facing a potential 4-year ban from competing in all major sports and hosting international events after they were found to have tampered with drug test data they'd given to investigators earlier this year. Our Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
There is something soothing about the sound of a curling stone gliding on ice. But for Russia's national team, these are nervous times. Like all athletes here, they're sliding towards a 4-year ban from global sport. The latest twist in the scandal over doping.
I'm not trying to think that further.
The curling captain, Anna Sidorova, is doing her best to blot it all out until WADA, the anti-doping agency, announces its sanctions.
Still, I'm training and I'm just trying to focus on this because that's the area that I can control.
President de la Fédération de Russie, Vladimir Putin.
The problems go back to the 2014 Sochi Olympics. for Russia and for President Putin, those games were a display of strength, skill, superiority. But the proud picture was shattered when a scientist blew the whistle on a massive state-backed doping scheme. This man was part of the cleanup act.
This is my working paper.
Yuri Ganas was hired to run Russia's reformed anti-doping agency, and he's been praised for not tolerating cheats. But for Russia to be fully reinstated, the sports ministry had to release a database of athletes' test results. Mr. Ganas told me that file had been heavily doctored.
I saw a huge list of changes, and I really didn't understand how it's possible. Quantity of these changes was thousands.
So for that, structure, Russian athletes are facing even greater sanctions. Yuri Ganas has come under pressure for speaking out, even threatened. But he insists that those responsible for this crisis should be removed. The sports minister was busy this week promoting exercise for all, an active lifestyle. The event I got to was devoted to amateur football. The sanctions WADA is considering would be a blow to a whole generation of professional athletes. But when I challenged the minister on who altered that database, he refused repeatedly to answer me. The head of the cross-country skiing federation was way more outspoken. Yelena Vyalba is clearly a patriot. She's got a picture of Vladimir Putin on horseback on her wall. Why should we believe WADA and not people here, she wants to know. This anti-Russian hysteria is a soap opera we've seen before. As for doctoring the database, Yelena asked me, do people think we're stupid? Some clearly do.
It's just such stupidity. It's outrageous. It's like some Monty Python stuff.
But Sergei Medvedev from Moscow's Higher School of Economics thinks this was less of a Kremlin-led cover-up than a clumsy attempt by former sports cheats who now have influence to protect what remains of their reputations.
We will never know this.
He thinks President Putin actually wants Russia reintegrated into world sports. And unlike world politics, that means playing by the rules.
Putin can get away with Crimea, but he cannot get away with doping. And you cannot do sports on your own.
Russia's champion curlers, all its athletes, have devoted years of training aiming for much higher targets. And it's their sporting futures that will soon be decided.
Sarah Rainsford reporting. In the latest in a series of reforms to Saudi Arabia's strict social rules, restaurants in the kingdom will no longer be required to have separate entrances for men and women. I heard more about the change, which comes despite a crackdown on dissent, from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
It used to be, I mean, going back a bit, quite odd. I mean, very different from most other places that you would go to. Essentially, single men, groups of men, would both go in separately and often to a separate area within a restaurant. I mean, restaurants not necessarily being that huge, there'd be like screens between the two areas. And it would be quite strictly enforced by the waiters, by the people running the restaurant, because they were scared, essentially, that they'd get into trouble if it was seen that that wasn't being properly observed. And those days, and until maybe 3, possibly 4 years ago, the religious police were still out on the streets, particularly in Riyadh. And that's what people are really scared of. The fact that they've now gone has meant that the relaxation has already sort of started in many of these sorts of areas.
So this is part of a series of reforms. Men and women can go through the same entrance into a restaurant.
I know. It doesn't sound such a big thing when you hear it that way. But in Saudi Arabia, I have to say, the feeling, I was talking to a lot of people when I was there a week or two ago. And I mean, one woman, for example, is half Saudi, lives in New York, but she comes back often. She's a fashion expert with her own line. And she was saying that she actually feels when she goes back now, often that she's thinking in a more conservative way than her Saudi girlfriends are, because things have moved quicker than she expected it to. And one of the things she mentioned was about restaurants and this sense that she was walking to a restaurant and holding back and thinking, I shouldn't go this way or that way. And they were like, you know, there's no restriction here anymore. So as I say, these things have already been happening to a greater or lesser extent. Each month or so, you have another rule, another announcement relaxing these restrictions. Saudi Arabia is trying to sell itself in a very different way, a very different image. But of course, it has lots of problems in that regard.
our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. A work of art featuring an overripe banana that was about to be sold for $120,000 has been eaten by another artist. The piece by the Italian artist Maurizio Catalan was on show at an art fair in Miami when it was devoured. Angus Crawford takes up the story.
A banana stuck to a white wall with silver duct tape. Actually, a work of art entitled Comedian. One minute, the object of fascination for hundreds of onlookers. The next...
art performance. Hungry artist.
Ripped off the wall by the performance artist David Datuna and eaten. Between mouthfuls, he asked how much anyone would pay for this new work he named Hungry Artist.
150,000.
One of those who witnessed the creation of the new masterpiece was Daniel Ponte.
He was repeating all the time when the police arrived, saying that it was part of his performance. In the same way that as the artist put the banana on the wall, he say, I'm coming here to eat the banana. That's my performance. And he left and the police removed him from the fair.
A replacement banana was soon taped back on the wall. According to the gallery, the value of the work lay in the idea behind it, not the individual piece of fruit.
Angus Crawford. For some time now, church going in the UK has been in decline, down 15% in the past decade. But it seems that one form of worship is bucking the trend. According to Church of England figures, attendance at choral evensong is up, enjoying a rise of 35% since 2007. Catherine King is a music psychologist at Magdalen College, Oxford. Her doctoral thesis looks at how people experience choral evensong. So why is this ancient service proving so attractive in the modern age?
There are probably almost as many reasons for attending as there are people that attend. And I think that is perhaps down to the very unique way in which choral evensong is constructed as a church service. So it's very musical and it doesn't really ask anything practical of the people who go and listen to it. So you can engage with it intellectually, you can engage with it musically, or you can sit and relax and let the beautiful music and the beautiful surroundings just become absorbed. Really, whatever mood you're in and whatever you're looking for, people are telling me that choral evensong can offer something to them. Lots of the people that come, of course, are Anglicans, but many of them are Christians of other denominations. And many people who've contacted me about my research have been very keen to say to me, this isn't just about coming as an Anglican to take part in a Church of England service. I'm a Hindu, I'm an atheist, I'm a humanist. And of course, when you go to a choral evensong service, there is no obligation to commit to any particular set of beliefs or to prove that you have any beliefs. It's open to everybody.
Catherine King, a music psychologist at Magdalen College, Oxford. And we'll end this edition of the podcast with the Advent hymn, Lo, He Comes with Clouds Descending, with the words of Charles Wesley. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.